trickling streams find their way to the rivers, and they are rivers. Rivers run to the ocean, and they are ocean. Blessings fall upon you like soft rain from the lofty clouds, filling the holy grail of our hearts as sunlight fills space. These moments together are timelessness. They are resonance, here and now. They are discovery of who you are, not who you become, but who you've always been. Welcome to Star Media Transmission, dedicated to the great mystery. I want to thank you, Hannah, for your incredible kindness and for giving your offerings in the way that you do. I know that it's delicate because the Aboriginal people are very, very concerned about what they do and don't give. And I know that you're doing it in a very good way. And we've had a lot of thankful letters concerning your interviews. And I just want to thank you. So here we have, again, Hannah Rachel Bell. And I would like that in the future we have Hannah Rachel Bell a lot. So this will not be the last time. Hannah, how are you doing?
Oh, look, I'm really good. I've just spent the weekend, you know, when you can't walk, it poses certain difficulties when you want to travel somewhere.
I can imagine.
So the bus company, TransWA, let me take my great big wheelchair, you know the one.
I call it
Hercule, after Poirot, all right?
Your little torpedo.
So they let me take it on the bus, and they forklifted it up to the bus, and honestly, I was looked after like a princess. I could get used to this, really. The treatment that they're, all the transport, the taxis and everybody you're giving me is just fantastic.
That's beautiful.
So anyway, I had a wonderful weekend, got horribly sunburned, but watched my granddaughter, aged 4, riding horses in competition, which is just completely out there.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine age 4 in competition.
Age 4.
Yeah. Yeah, wow, wow.
So
wow.
That was that. And you can probably see how sunburned I am with my owly eyes.
Yeah, you look good, though.
Do I?
Yeah,
oh, that's good.
You look really good. Clear picture.
Now I was, you know, when we were sort of wondering what we're going to talk about today, one of the things that's really struck me is how spirits, human spirits, my spirit, your spirit, recognize each other.
Yep. Yep.
And for me, that's a really interesting thing. Many years ago, when I was running a cultural awareness course with all of the Western Australian Police Force, as you can imagine, that was quite a challenge. the sergeant who, Paul Bella, who was assigned to take me around the Pilbara to all the police stations, he and I were driving on a remote Pilbara road where you literally travel hundreds and hundreds of kilometres without seeing, you know, anybody, when I saw some smoke spiring, you know, in the off-road. And I said to Mike, just pull up. I think there's a bunch of blackfellas down there. I think there's a camp there somewhere. So we pulled up and I got out of the car, and Mike always walked behind me in these situations. And we walked to the side of the road and then down into the bush. And then out of the bush came a black fella. And he just looked at me. And I said, "Hey, what now? What happening?" He said, like that gesture, which means, which interpreted means, "My whole family is over there and they're having a cup of tea." I said, "Ah, yo, nalija," which is Ngaranyan for a cup of tea. And then he just looked at me and he said, "I'm no you." I said, "I don't think I've ever met you. You're Pilbara Mom. I'm Kimberley Mom." He said, "I'm no you. You're right." So we then had a conversation and a few more people came over, and it was an instant knowing.
Yes.
Now, I have that experience a lot, not just in Western Australia, not just in outback Australia, but in many places around Australia where Aboriginal people are, whether it's in a supermarket or a park. Where they just look at you, and you can tell by the way they look at you that they're searching for something. It's like they experience something, and then they're searching in my eyes and my face somehow, and I just let that happen. I open up, you know.
Of course.
Open up. And then they'll smile or, you know, or nod or or just a gesture like that, and say, and then what they might say, "Where are you from?" And then they have that really interesting experience for them, is that they're looking at me with a lot of curiosity. "Hey, you got here, white fella. How come you see like we see?"
Right, right.
Yeah?
Yes. Sahara's sitting here smiling huge. Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Absolutely.
"How come you see like we see?" And it's like an instant downloading of history, of heritage, of spirit, of it's like we both enter a stream of knowing which really hasn't got any words.
That's right. May I come in here, Hannah? Is that fine?
Yeah.
You know, in India, I have a similar thing going on. I tell a story about one night. It must have been about 8:30 in the evening when everything was on the streets. The people were still milling around, a lot of people, and it was about the time when people start to come down, go home, end their day. And I just had to leave my room, and I didn't know why I had to leave my room. But this has happened a few times. I just want to give this example. And I just walked up this little hill, up the road, up this little hill to the main road, and I bumped into an elderly Indian woman. And she looked at me, and I looked at her, and it was over. And I just knew. We never spoke a word to each other. We just, there was a transmission of knowing. And you know what's really interesting about that? In your elaboration of this situation of mine, we never forget these people. We meet hundreds and hundreds of people, thousands of people in our lives. And these people mark us. In some way, we're marked in that moment because there's such a deep knowing. Is that, that's your experience as
that's
well?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And it even, you know, it even extends from that, Shanti Mai, where, you know, I can be with Aboriginal people, especially remote, this happens, and there might be another Gadia here, you know, talking. And that guardian might ask a question, and those black fellows will immediately look at me, and And I'll go like that, you know, I'll sort of cock my head on the side. It's, so much is gesture.
Yeah.
You know, so which is what gesture. I want to talk about today as well. But,
great.
And I just sort of, my gesture is, you right with that question?
Mm-hmm.
And it's happened so often. The black fella will say to this gadia, she know, you ask her. Right?
Right, right.
She know, you ask her.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
We don't even know each other. You know, it's a stranger's thing. Like I texted to you earlier, you know, this strangers yet intimate.
Yes. And not strangers.
No,
somehow,
strangers
somehow.
In this world
yes.
experience.
Yes.
But at other levels, in other ways, that I don't personally understand. I just know what the experience is. Mm. And I don't actually have that with white fellas very often. Like, you know, I could probably count on my thumb.
Me too.
That I have that sense with white fellas. And that's a really interesting, because Aboriginal people, especially remote, urban Aboriginal people have a lot of kind of defences up, particularly with white fellas, because their experience of discrimination is and oppression and violence and all of that is so living that any white fella, you know, is a potential bully.
Yes.
In some way.
Unfortunately, but, yes.
But with remote black fellas, I call remote Aboriginal people, it's a completely different experience, and it puts me in a space that is unique to that engagement. With white fellas, I just feel that there are as many barrier layers, you know, as layers of clothes they're wearing and makeup they're wearing and, you know, whatever. I don't know what it is. There just seems to be these barriers where they won't let you into their eyes.
Yes, and do you think that they're aware of that?
Well, yes, I do. But do you know why I think they're aware of it? Because often when I do look for them in their eyes, they'll gasp and take a step back.
Uh-huh, avoid, in other words.
Like they go,
yeah.
And step back as if to say, my God, this person's climbing into my head.
Right. Right, which you are not, actually. You're just looking for that familiarity, that deep familiarity.
Looking for the essence.
Yes.
That looking for the essence, for the resonance, the flow that can connect us in our humanity.
Right, and even deeper.
Well, indeed.
Thank you.
Indeed.
But
yeah.
So I want to make this very clear. This has nothing to do with prejudice against our own race and romanticism towards the Aboriginal. It's just pure experience. Is that what you're saying?
It is pure experience, and it's not prejudice to my own people and culture. All my blackfella friends know very well that, you know, after a month of being out bush, I can't wait to get into it. Air conditioning, clean white tile floors, and having a shower, you know, with sweet smelling, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they have quite a, you know, a lot of humour at my expense about Hey, Hannah there, she ready to go. She ready to go hotel.
She ready to go to
the hotel. She ready to go hotel.
Yeah.
So it's not that. But, you know, with Gaudiya white fellas, I don't know. It's, you know, possibly a fear.
Yes, it is, Anna. That's
yeah,
my
do you think?
Well, at least some of it is. That's my experience. People fear people who are, well, this is my experience, so I'm not guessing about this, and it's not everyone, of course. But I've had the experience where people really fear hurtful people, people who actually wouldn't get into your mind. Because, I mean, I don't want to get into my own mind. I tell people this all the time. I don't want to, I'm not interested in my own mind. Why would I be interested in yours, right?
Are you speaking my language?
Yeah, but there's something about the fear of being touched in the heart. And I think those eyes do that when they're softly peering into the next human being. And I found that people do not want to be touched where they have not touched themselves. To me, it's almost like, dare you touch my heart, dare you open me up when I myself have not touched my heart nor open myself up. Don't do that. Does that make sense to you?
Well, it does actually. And just this weekend, I had this experience where somebody that I love absolutely, an adult, absolutely so dearly and treasure so deeply, wouldn't or couldn't even say hello.
Wow.
Couldn't even say hello.
Is it because of your condition, Harry?
Well, I think it must be because, you know, I was really quite hurt, to be honest, and was glad to, you know, pick up my four-year-old granddaughter, stick her on my lap and give her the controls of the wheelchair, and we went tearing around the showground like a mad dog, which was so much fun and so funny that it took me out of the pain, you know, pretty well immediately. But this went on for 2 days. This person simply would not acknowledge me, let alone have a conversation. So, you know, I came back to Fremantle, and blow me down if this person hasn't posted on Facebook how wonderful it was to see me and that I enjoyed, you know, the this and that and the other, and, you know, hope you had a safe trip home. Big smiley and kisses.
Well, I think I have an insight into that, Hannah. Yeah. I feel that if you, not if you, that you revere this person so deeply, and this person must revere you too, because that doesn't happen on one side and not the other. Mm. When someone who loves you sees that you are, but you, see, I don't see you as that, but every perception belongs to each person. When they see you as not where you used to be, let's just say in the wheelchair, I think a lot of projection goes on. They probably can't see you laughing and playing with the granddaughter in such ways. They probably see it much differently. And I think that people create a lot of pain around these kind of situations for themselves, because I think it comes back to, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it comes back to the fear of one's own life being affected. And the way I see you is you handle this very well and have a great sense of humor and hold yourself buoyant over the difficulty, even though you're struck with the difficulty, you hold yourself buoyant over the difficulty. I'm not sure that everybody can see that, because they are projecting their own sorrow. They're projecting their own ideas. What do you think about that, Hannah?
Look, I agree with you. But again, you know, the difference between how blackfellas
yeah,
view
let's go
me
there.
In the wheelchair, because I'm very tall. I'm 5'10".
Yeah. You look,
and I've got
you look six
shoulders
foot five
that
to
carry
me.
The world.
That's right. Eh? Yeah. You know? Do. Yeah.
You know, most women and probably half the men that I know are my height or shorter. So they're usually looking up to me.
I do.
Yeah. When I stand up.
Yeah, when you stand up. I was surprised how tall you are.
You know, I just sort of keep growing and growing as a Boy Scout once told me at my first Scout and Guide dance, when he asked me to dance and I got up, his eyes just followed me up and up, and he said, "God, what do they feed you on, manure?" and being an extremely gawky, self-conscious 13-year-old, it was pretty devastating. But to be somebody that you look at eye to eye or slightly up to, and then you're looking down to them.
Yep, that's the same.
You know, sitting in a wheelchair.
Exactly, that's the same thing I'm talking about. It's a projection.
Mm.
And it's a pouring, it's a heart pouring. I think that it requires compassion on our part to see people on that side of the situation, not being able to understand fully or see fully that things are okay. They're not the way they used to be, but they're going along.
But you know what, Shanti Mai? It makes you realize how black fellas must feel.
This is what I'd like to
hear. All the time. Or people of difference. You know?
That's interesting.
Others.
Yep.
When white fellas look at Aboriginal people, I'm sure there's fear, and it's a fear of ignorance, a fear of sort of not knowing. But there's also a value judgment about lifestyle and
Absolutely.
What values are evidence and all of that sort of thing. And then there's a kind of a nervousness, you know, almost like an anxious tension.
Mm-hmm.
What do I say? You know, where do I look?
Mm-hmm.
How do I deal with this situation? And for me in the wheelchair, and for most black fellas, we're not self-conscious about
exactly
how we look or the only time I ever think about my condition honestly is when somebody tells me about it.
Yeah, I can see that, Jana. I can see that very well. You know, going back to the black fella and the cultural thing, when I was in the Kimberley one time, there was a big flood. And the person who was guiding us back there towards the, back in the Mitchell Plateau area.
Yeah.
She went inside the Aboriginals' home. Well, she knows them, and I think that that was okay, no problem. And she came out and she said, "The dogs just ripped up a leather couch, just ripped it in half." You know, just, and she was just so, I say, they don't care about leather couches.
No.
And she was just so excited, you know. They just let them rip it up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a dog bone, you know, to them. I mean, it's the difference in our culture, isn't it, Hannah? And I'd like to ask you one more thing. When you are having that experience of that knowing, what do you think is transmitted between the two of you?
Well, certainly something is happening in our eyes. There's something happening in our eyes. But I think there's also some other metabolic sort of physiological things that are happening, like a change of heartbeat.
Yes.
A change of breathing. You know, if there's an anxiety, then the breathing, you know, just gets a little bit
rougher,
you know, more rapid.
Right.
And you know, but I think the knowing relaxes the breathing, and that in itself opens up to other body gesture changes, you know, subtle changes, just little changes like a shift of a foot towards you or sideways, or the removal of a guarding hand from the face, or there's eyes, there's breath, there's gesture.
There's meeting and acceptance.
And then I think there's some other communique transmission happening that, that I can't identify, but is most evident in, similarity is evident when you have a group of women, like in a convent or the Amazon women, and where they, and even random women collecting in a room where, their ovaries start talking to each other.
That happens.
It happens.
Yeah, that's right. And that must have something to do with the, it must have everything to do with the consciousness that perceptive, responsive, experiential, I don't know if it's an energy field, but whatever that field is that we call consciousness, that seamlessness, that like the sun feeds the leaves and the water feeds the root, somehow we feed each other in that seamlessness as well when we meet well like that. Don't you think that's true?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Well,
I'm getting a bit of feedback. Are you getting that?
No.
Okay.
We're good.
Good.
Okay. Hannah, in that, like like you call the remote Aboriginal, they must be very much in touch with the old ways. I mean, to some degree, they must be. Is that not right?
Oh, they absolutely. They never lost it. In fact, I find that even with, with urban Aboriginal people who've had nothing to do with, who've just grown up urban, they once they're in the bush, it just kind of pops awake. But with remote Aboriginal people, they are constantly in touch. They are in their, and you learn. I mean, my walking the country with Ngarrinyan, you just learn by copying, the footstep, the lightness of footstep, the way you place your feet even. Where you put your hands, normally women are walking with their hands behind their back, or they're holding a digging stick, but it's the lightness of tread, it isn't clump, 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 you avoid sticks, and it's a lightness of tread because you don't want to disturb the snake or the goanna, and if you're looking for bush tucker, then you don't want to announce to every bush turkey within 10 kilometres that you're in the area.
Yeah, that's right. I want to clear a couple of things up there. That bush tucker is food that you get in the bush, and the goanna is the lizard animal. Thank you. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So, so you're constantly open to the communicates the transmissions that are coming from nature.
Yes.
And you're also very aware that you are transmitting to nature.
What do you think you're transmitting to nature, Hannah? That's very interesting. I think most people would not even consider such a thing. They would consider it the other way around. Do you think that's true, Sahar? That you're getting transmitted from nature, but that... What would you transmit to nature, Hannah? That's really a beautiful...
Well, you're transmitting your energy.
Yep.
And, your energy meets their energy, and it's as though, it's as though a tree will respond by gusting a wind gust at you. I mean, that happened to me as well this weekend.
Yep.
You know, it's as though in acknowledgement of your acknowledgement, there's a gust of wind or a little spiral of a dust devil, you know, a little willy-willy. Or birds. Birds pick you up immediately.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
And they just, they'll let themselves be, they'll come scooping in on you, or they'll suddenly pick up something off the ground right in front of you.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So you know that there's some kind of communication. Even kangaroos know whether you're hunting them or you're not hunting them. They stand up and look at you when they hear a noise, and they look, and they'll all stand up and look.
And they're of one mind, aren't they?
Well, they seem to be. And if you've, you know, got a gun or something, then they're gone. in my muddy, which is my mud brick cottage that I had until recently, I had 16 acres of land, which was the home territory of a mob of kangaroos. And they would just graze all around the house. I've got photos of them peeking in the window. You know, I didn't feed them or anything, but they learned my energy. Now, I started doing my Tai Chi at a regular time at 11 o'clock in the morning, and I'd go outside. I loved doing Tai Chi under the trees. And then I started to notice the kangaroos coming in. They didn't come close, you know, maybe 30 metres away. And it was like an audience.
I could see it in my mind. I could see it in my mind's eye.
I've got photographs of the kangaroos all standing up, watching me do Tai Chi. And this, you know, if it was only once, I'd say it was coincidence.
Right.
But it became a pattern. You know, every day, and I used to say to friends, watch through the window, this will blow your mind.
This is beautiful.
So, do we transmit to nature? Of course we do.
Of course.
And if we're transmitting to birds and kangaroos, then we're also transmitting to trees and insects.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Last week in the circle, somebody asked what was the benefit of a quiet mind. I said, well, then you can hear the umbrella tree sing and crackle in the wind. And I came home to where it's my home for a couple weeks, and I was speaking to the umbrella tree. I can see it right now. And I said, tonight you were in the circle, and just a little gust of wind came up and shook it, you know. And I knew I was communicating to it. I knew that I was not communicating to a wall and pretending. I was communicating to the tree, and the tree was listening. And I feel also when we have great, my experience, when we have great intentions, mine are always in the night before I go to sleep, for the people who are around me, who have asked and who I care about and know about. I feel that when I put out any request for someone's good health or whatever it may be, I feel that the stars are listening.
Mm. So it was interesting when you appeared in my life via the Sacred Circle mob in Frio, Fremantle.
The Sacred Circle mob, I love it.
We finally have a name.
We do have a name. Thank you, Hannah. That's great.
Is there another name?
Well, no, there is not. Not anymore.
So, you know, I mean, what do you expect? You know, I'm this bush lady, you know, who sits under trees in the dirt with blackfellas and gains my awareness and awakening from the land and from these absolutely soulful, wonderful people.
Mm.
And then I hear about this woman called Shanti Mai. So I immediately go to Google.
Oh, gosh.
And look up, to try and look up what does shanti mean, because the only shanti I know is, you know, a rather irreverent sailor's jingle called a shanti.
Okay.
So I'm thinking, well, that's not it.
that's not it.
And then I looked up Mai, and then I looked up all the rest, and I really wasn't any wiser with, you know, with a Google search.
Thank
you. So I was quite looking forward to meeting, you know, after we'd done a couple of Skype things, the early ones.
Right.
So I was quite looking forward to meeting. And my initial reaction was twofold. It was, oh, my God, I see her, she sees me, and I switched it off immediately.
Right.
Because I thought, no, that, you know, there's too much here that I can't get my head around. This American woman with an ashram in the Pyrenees and something else in India with a funny name.
Wait a minute, Hannah Rachel Bell.
Yeah. Sitting here in jeans and a sweat, looking completely ordinary.
Yep.
And I said to Jen, my host here, you know, I said, you know what, Jen? I mean, I don't know whether, you know, gurus have a special aura or anything, but I just felt that I could have been looking in a mirror.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And I sure as hell don't feel like I've got any aura.
You do, Hannah.
You sure as hell do.
You sure as hell do, Sahara said. She turned bright red on
after,
that one.
It was after we'd actually shared humour and swapped stories that whatever I was resisting, I let it go.
Oh, yeah.
And then there was a rush, and it was like a rush. Hey, I wasn't wrong. It is as though I'm looking in the mirror. And I thought, oh, and what came into me just so strongly was the morning, evening star, morning star story that, you know, in Ngarrindjeri of morning star and evening star, you know, kind of navigating the world and, you know, guiding the rotation of the world, and yet it's the same star.
Mm-hmm. That's it. Yeah, that's beautiful.
And that's that kind of morning star and evening star are always strangers because they're in opposite parts of the sky. But, of course, They're the same.
Yeah, not differentiated in any way, shape, or form. Yeah, that's beautiful. I love it. I love it, Hannah. I'm also looking in the mirror.
Yeah. You wear pearls. I wear pearl shell.
Yeah. I notice, and I really also when. When I heard you the first time, I thought, this is somebody I want to know. And luckily, it happened.
Yeah. That's right. But what it makes me realize is that, I mean, you know, this is this knowing.
This is knowing. The point.
Mm. And I said to Shumbo, it took a nanosecond. I didn't tell him then that I switched it off because it scared the hell out of me, but I switched it on again, and let you in.
Mm-hmm. 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 Are you speaking about Shambho or Shanti Mai?
Shanti Mai.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Now I have a very old friendship with Shambho that goes back 25 years.
I was delighted when the two of you were talking. I was delighted. Your sense of humor is so, so rich and so raw. And I love that. It's not at all sophisticated, and it's totally free and open and generous and incredibly funny, you guys. Honest to God. I love that. It was beautiful. Yeah.
Well, you know, we're a bit like the landscape, aren't we?
Very much so.
Raw, rugged.
Yes. Yes.
In your face.
Yes. I live in such a place as well. If your health was better, I would bring you there. Maybe your health is going to be better anyhow. Who knows?
Well, it might be. I've been mucking around with this magnesium, so we'll see how I go with it.
Okay.
Squirting it on myself here and there. The other thing that I wanted to... it's nearly an hour already.
That's okay. Please go.
The other thing that I thought would be good to talk about is gesture. But you wanted to...
Video that.
Video,
yeah,
gesture.
I do. So can we do that, Hannah? Can we do that before I leave Australia? Because the camera is very good.
Right.
Yeah, and I can get a desktop recording. I think I have a program that does that.
You can do.
Yeah, yeah. So I would really love to do that before I go. And I'm leaving Tuesday.
Tuesday?
Yeah.
I don't want to hear that.
I don't want to hear it either. Part of the reason I came to Australia this time was to meet up with you, because I actually felt like I belonged in another part of the world right now, the United States. But I thought I better rush right over there and just get in contact with Hannah.
Oh, well, I'm so, you know, what a good thing to do.
Yeah, we had a great time, and we're still having a great time, and we're going to continue to have a great time.
Yes. Well, that's good. So we'll make a time and talk about gesture and
yes.
language.
Yes.
Now, you also suggested we talk about the concept of time. We've actually done that in one of the recordings, I think the second one.
Okay.
But I'll re-listen to that and see if that, you know, if that really explored the concept of time or the timelessness of time.
Okay.
You know, exploring the multidimensional experience of the present rather than looking at a linear concept of time. Let's re-listen to that and
okay.
see if we covered it off.
Okay.
And if we didn't, then we'll do time as talk about time as well. Because time, in fact, is one of the most challenging and interesting concepts, but once you get the idea that once you know more than just an intellectual concept, you know, that once you get the experience
there
of living
go.
Fully in a multi-dimensional present.
There you go. That's the thing there, right there.
Mm.
Mm, right
and,
there.
And you experience it.
That's the thing, experience.
And like now I'm sitting at this table and the table is talking to me. We're in conversation and I, you know, you've seen my garden here.
Yes.
You know, the garden comes in. It comes in reflections. It comes in smells.
Yes.
You know?
Sitting with you, I have had that experience of the garden. The garden moving into your experience outside the door, coming inside the door.
Mm.
Exactly as you're saying.
So we'll do that. We'll have a listen and see, and then and see if we explored it all there.
I would love that, Hannah. And to close this wonderful time with you, as usual, and people love it, in those meetings when everything is open and transmitted, how would you suggest that people open themselves to that meeting in that moment? How would you suggest that they free themselves from avoidance?
Well, the active thing to do is to change the way you look at someone. When we look at someone in a defended way, which is what we think is normal, we, you know, we'll notice things like, what do you look like, whether your hair's done, what you're wearing, you know, all of that sort of stuff.
Whether you gained weight or lost weight, whether you're getting older.
All of that.
Yeah, all of that. Yeah, that's a good point. Go ahead, please.
You know, that's how we look. But we're also looking in a detached way because our mind is thinking up what we're going to say. All right?
Yeah.
So we're actually, you know, if I'm looking at you, I'm thinking about what I'm going to say next. And as soon as I'm in that mode, I'm not receiving anything.
That's right.
Or I'm not allowing you in.
That's right.
Because I'm my words and my, I'm actually putting my words in the way of the openness.
Is that, do you think that that is, Hannah, we have a few minutes left here. Do you think that that has to do with the fear of what one may think of you? Do you think that that's part of that?
Well, it could be, but I think as much it's the way we Westerners have been conditioned into relying so incredibly heavily on our intellectual, and I'm not talking about being smart, but about a choice between engaging through our language control thought side of ourselves rather than our receptive, creative, visual, receptive, you know, the bit that absorbs the smells and the textures and the, you know, all that creative stuff. So, you know, I'm a bit down on words, she says, who's a writer, but I think in interaction, because we fill silence with words, we maintain a barrier between us. When you stop the words, and then you're not looking at a person, you change your focus to looking in a person, you get past all of that, you don't see any of that, and in the process you've opened yourself
exactly
and to a flow which is non-verbal.
Right, and those I was just going to say about verbal, that verbal chatter happens more in the mind than it does exteriorly. Yeah. So it's not like spoken words, it's like how we think about things. Isn't that so?
It is. Yeah. And it's that same deal where, you know, if we're constructing what we're going to say next.
Exactly.
Then that's that kind of verbiage that is like a hedge.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely like a shield. Mm-hmm.
It's probably, you know, one of the most challenging and confronting things to do is to sit cross-legged in front of a person and just to look into each other's eyes.
I think that's a wonderful thing to do.
Yeah, and when you recognize that you're analyzing, let it go.
Right.
Let it go, let it go, let it go. And eventually, and it can be a very short time, but eventually you'll just join in the same flow.
I love the word join energy. There, that join, because it breaks down all of the barriers. Yep.
Yeah, you'll. But even a better word is this idea of littoral, which we've talked about before.
That's so good.
When you allow that literal space to be alive, then it has its own force and identity and power, you know, you are interlapping your energies, aren't you?
Yes, we live in that, don't we? Mm. We're alive in that. Mm. Mm-hmm. And in being alive in that enriches every moment, whether you notice it or not, it just does. You know, and sometimes you notice it and sometimes you don't notice it. But the life is incredibly rich because you're open. I was saying the other day that to open your heart actually becomes your protection rather than to protect the heart. Not that you need protection, but it's exactly as you say, that you read the entire landscape much greater when your heart is open rather than protecting it. Heart being another brain.
The idea of opening your heart, I've struggled with that because I don't, you know, I don't actually know what open your heart means, other than when I open my eyes, it seems that there is a powerful rush flow into my heart.
Well, that's the thing. It's called receptivity. That's all it is. But I don't want to demean it by saying that's all it is, because receptivity is it's a bottomless. It's like Alice in Wonderland. How deep do you want to go into that receptivity?
It's all it is.
Yeah, it's all it is. It's like the waterfall and the basin. To me, it's the basin and the waterfall, and the onflow. Because whatever you receive, you're giving. What you're not receiving, you're not giving. So, in my view, Hannah, opening the heart means to be receptive, and to each person, that means something.
Yeah.
So I can understand.
Well, I noticed that in your, you know, when you're with your sacred circle mob, when you're just sort of sitting there and somebody asks you a question and they're open, because you can hear their openness in their voice.
Yeah.
And
you can.
Undefendedness.
Right.
And then I watch and listen to what you do, which is half as often, you know, almost ignore the question and go to some other answer.
It's true.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, okay, she's looked into this person and is picking up the other intended message, but the one that she wasn't, the questioner wasn't quite game or didn't know how to articulate.
That's right. I had this experience the other night, Hannah. One woman was saying she's just so misunderstood. And we were talking about words and how language affects our experience. How she was so misunderstood, Okay, then you have maybe to be clear, but I missed the point and she missed the point. And in the middle of the night, I woke up with the point. It's not that she is misunderstood. It's that she misunderstands herself. Mm. And when she will come around to understand herself, which means basically to cease doubting herself, to have faith in what she can do, to be willing to make mistakes without beating herself over the head, those kinds of things, huh? Then she'll be very well understood, no problem. And if she's not, she won't care so much, you know?
Well, that's right. Well, you know, that sort of being misunderstood is really looking at yourself in the way you construct other people to look at you. In other words, you look at them looking at you and you immediately say, oh, they're not understanding, or they're not hearing, or they're disapproving, or they're judging, or whatever. And it's all as though, you'll project. What in that fabulous book, A Course in Miracles.
Oh, yeah.
I project the world I see.
That's right.
And second, in my defenselessness lies my strength.
Absolutely. I say that too. In vulnerability, there is an incredible power of strength there. It's stability right in the middle of vulnerability. Everything's shaking on the outside, but right there you are. Mm.
And that brings us full circle back to the Ngarrinyan, because when you live in a sociocentric or a collective consciousness rather than an egocentric individual consciousness,
right?
When you live in that, then the ego just isn't there.
Right. There's no such thing. It's a construct.
And so you are in a constant state of vulnerability.
Yes, yes, yes. The only problem I have with the term ego is that rather than just saying, okay, it's a kind of closed feeling of a separate individuality, that would be okay with me. But every wrong action, which is perfectly fine, wrong action is perfectly fine, it's a directive. All of the nastiness that we think of ourselves and we think of other gets kind of stuffed in that idea of ego. And it becomes like this, they say you have to get rid of your ego. No, you don't have one. What you must do is relax the idea that you're separate, basically. Don't you think that's true, Hannah?
I do, and I think in addition to that, I think we might have talked about this before,
mm-hmm.
but... in our humanity, we have this incredible range of potentials.
Oh, yes.
And that includes anger and frustration and jealousy,
yes.
And all of those things. And my view of those things is not to try and expunge myself of all these value-laden nasties.
Yes.
But instead to say, what's the function of that?
Yep.
Because I am in the image of God, therefore... it has a function, and it was Jesus who went in the temple and with all the money lenders and, rip-off artists, and it was Jesus who said, what do you think you're doing? This is a place of worship. And he rampaged around and turned up all the tables and chucked them all out.
Right, right.
Nothing gentle, Jesus, sweet and mild in that. That was... he was as angry as hell.
Right, and he didn't head off to the Garden of Gethsemane and be fret needing to relieve himself of his ego.
No.
No, he didn't. He didn't. So
his anger had the function
absolutely
of making a very big statement,
That's right.
Quite an emphatic statement. And so that's how I look at things, is to... I'm not for a moment giving license to rampaging anger.
Me too.
Because
me too.
I'm not doing that at all. All I'm saying is, when we're feeling it, just push the pause button on it and say, let me simultaneously figure out what function this is happening. In other words, what will be the consequences? What are the possible outcomes?
Absolutely.
And whether its roots are in something healthy,
yep,
or something painful,
and
if it's in something painful,
yep.
Then look at the pain.
That's right.
And because that's another one, not to get rid of the pain, but to immerse in it, just to know what the experience of it is, and to say, all right, how is this protecting or developing or enhancing or amplifying me in some way.
Right, right. What benefit does this have? And if it doesn't have benefit, at least I understand that it doesn't have benefit.
That's
and I
right.
can move on, we've got, the poor humanity has been so stuck in such innocent places, and it's become very, very rough for people. So I have given up the idea of ego. And I agree with you totally on that. But I feel that they pack more ideas into there. And one of the things, Hannah, is that if we look through through the eyes of separation, what we see is separation. So then we say, oh, his ego, look at the, it's true. He may be completely in his own element and unbeneficial to everyone and hurting and painful and self-aggrandizing. But though, okay, that's what he's doing. He's not packing it into this little concept. I just have a hard time with that because the Aboriginal people, none of the Indigenous people had the concept of ego. They weren't working in that separate idea. But anyhow, I go That's on right. and on about that thing. So
I agree.
Yeah, yeah, thank you for that.
I'm waiting for us to have a big argument. Not really.
That'll be really cool. Let's have it online so everybody can hear it. No, I think we see eye to eye from different angles, and I think that's very enriching for people. And I love the Indigenous people romantically, foolishly, deeply, with all of my heart, and I'm so willing to learn what's inside of me that has been laid with time and not awakened, not standing up in me. So this I just love to hear from you.
Well, all I can, you know, my only logical response is they're the original people.
They are.
Aboriginal. They're the originals. There is no other human existence on earth that has this continuous consciousness.
Yes. Yes, and for thousands and thousands of years did no harm to the earth, even in their own skirmishes and so on and so forth, you know, had no harm to the earth, didn't destroy it as fast as we have, yeah, or as fast as it has come. Who knows how that's happened, really? There's a lot of elements to that. Hannah, it's time to close this interview. Is that okay for you?
That's okay for me, Shanti Mai. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you too. And as one single drop of rain blesses the ocean, you too are a blessing in the ocean of boundless experience. Until we meet again, I am, as you are, here and now, the great Mistray.